Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a deep dive on traditional Hopi farming and new rules from the Biden administration on how healthcare companies should cover mental health. But first, the last 2 days on the show, we've been exploring this enduring American question: is there such a thing as a good guy with a gun? And today, for the third installment in our little mini-series, I wanted to offer my own experience with that dilemma. The story begins on a recent Saturday morning when I woke up at 6:30 and drove out to the Pioneer Living History Museum about 25 miles north of Glendale. I arrived just in time for roll call.
Bad Burrow! Big Bad John! Here. Desert Dingo!
Here!
Desert Gator!
Here!
Detox!
Here!
Dog Boy!
Oh.
Double D!
Here.
Ghost Rider!
Here!
Gray Wander!
Here!
Gut Shot Garth!
Here!
Half Cock Willie! Heartbreaker!
Yep!
Iceman! Moonshine Jack!
Yo!
No Angel!
Here!
Daisy! No Daisy!
By 8 a.m., with everyone accounted for, the crowd's attention turned towards a dirt path leading to a clearing where there was an antique cannon with a freshly lit fuse.
Listen up!
Listen up!
Everybody still here? Good. All right, so, anybody that's sitting down there by that cannon, it's going off and it's going to be loud.
And with that, the statewide competition of the Cowboy Fast Draw Association was officially underway. An older man in a wide-brim hat stepped up to a microphone and introduced himself as Quick Cal.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
What I've got for you this morning is more than words just of encouragement. It's words of wisdom.
The crowd pressed in close. Everyone was wearing authentic Old West attire. Boots, leather vests with tassels, leather chaps, flowing skirts, and corsets.
This is your sport, as much as it is mine. So, God bless you all. Shoot well today.
Somebody rang a bell, and Desert Dingo, Half Cock Willie, Gray Wonder, and the rest of them hustled over to a bulletin board, spurs jangling and holsters swinging from their hips. They were looking to see which bracket they'd be shooting in. I caught up with Gutshot Garth. He was feeling excited. Things had gone pretty well for him at the last statewide shoot.
I won a first place here in the A bracket, and then I won a second place last week in the B bracket. It's kind of like consolation prize for losers, but I'm competitive.
No, I was remembering that from our conversation last time, that you're here to win.
That's right. Yeah, but you know, it's just part of it. It's part of life.
I first met Gutshot Garth a few months earlier. His given name is Matthew Garth Giesling.
I come by being a gunfighter, honestly. It's definitely in my blood.
Matthew's dad was also a fast draw shooter. In fact, he was at a competition the day Matthew was born. When they brought him to the hospital to meet his son, he was still carrying the 2-gallon jug of Jack Daniels he won at the shoot.
My mom wanted to name me Matthew, and my dad, being a couple of sheets to the wind, took advantage of the situation and named me Matthew Garth. And Matthew Garth is the character in Red River with John Wayne, Montgomery Clift's character.
We were sitting in Matthew's dining room with his wife, Deborah. Deborah started going to the shoots to hang out with Matthew. But before long, one of the other shooters offered her a private lesson.
And so I did it just for fun. But as soon as I tried it, I was hooked. And I turned around. My husband was standing behind me, and he had already bought me a gun. Everybody in the group.
Oh, so you were waiting for this.
They were priming me. They were priming me.
Deborah is just as competitive as Matthew. So competitive, in fact, that she says they can't play board games together anymore. But they don't need board games. They're gunfighters now. Fast draw, to be clear, doesn't involve actual fighting. It's an individual sport. You load a revolver with bullets full of wax and stand in a line of fellow shooters facing a row of metal targets with a red light in the center. When the light comes on, you draw your weapon and fire at the target. If you miss, you don't get any points. But if you hit the target, a judge measures how much time it took for you to draw, fire, and hit. The fastest time wins.
So it was the opportunity to spend time together, doing something that Matthew really loved, and the competition that...
sealed the deal.
Okay. And the fact that we dress in character. Uh-huh. Yeah.
our youngest son calls it cosplay for adults.
Okay.
And I mean, we all have aliases.
Yes.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
And Deborah's is Arizona Mama Bear.
And who are you?
My alias is Gutshot Garth. And the reason why it's Gutshot Garth is...
I knew it was going to come to this.
Yeah. I have been shot 3 times when I was 17 years old, and I lived.
May I ask about the circumstances of the shooting?
Yeah, 3 men tried to rob me and murder me.
Oh, my God.
I was not a good person. I had lost my mom when I was 15 and left home at the age of 15. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of things that were in my life that I wish I had never done. Mm-hmm. And back in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a lot of stuff flowing across the border. And so I was part of that. And just dealing with alcohol and drug addiction and stuff like that.
I'm so sorry.
Don't be sorry. I wouldn't be the person that I am today if that hadn't happened.
Sure.
After Matthew got shot, he was rushed to the hospital, where doctors thought he was dead. After literally dozens of surgeries, he somehow got back on his feet, met Deborah, and became a Christian. He says he doesn't recognize the person he was back when he got shot.
Did getting shot change your relationship or your perspective on guns?
No, absolutely not. My father really inbred in me that you either have evil intentions or you have good intentions, and you have honorable intentions.
Matthew and Deborah, it turns out, have a lot of honorable intentions.
We serve families who are affected by serious mental illness. Our son has a serious mental illness, and he's been in the system, the adult system, for about 14 years. It's a very broken system.
During the day, Deborah runs a nonprofit that helps families like hers navigate the challenges of finding care for adults like her son. That's where she got her FASTRA alias, Arizona Mama Bear. Matthew's day job funds the nonprofit, and he also leads a faith-based discussion group for families affected by mental illness. They love their work, but the demands of their work are a big part of why they love FASTRA.
I do think that us doing this together at this time in our life, I think it's been God's mercy that everything we've been through with our son, especially, that we're together in it. Mm-hmm. And it drew us closer, where it's very common to hear marriages fall apart in these kind of crisis situations. And ours didn't. It was the opposite. And I think that was, again, God's grace to us. And then to me, this is just another, we've just done everything together really well since then.
When I go out and do fast draw, I can blank out the world and there's nothing else happening around me. But my wife's right there with me, and we can forget the cares of the day for those few hours of just peace.
Those feelings of escapism and peace are part of the kinship Deborah and Matthew feel with the people they shoot side by side with.
We all know each other by our aliases. Most of us don't even know our real names. We just call each other Arizona Mama Bear, whatever. We all have a similar kind of story that we were sharing with you, and I think everyone has a difficult thing they've walked through, or maybe they're walking through. And when we're all there, I think it's not spoken or said, but we all are kind of leaving that behind.
After the break, we'll get to know some of Matthew and Deborah's fellow gunfighters. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the financial complications of receiving mental health care. We'll hear from a health economist about the expansion of mental health parity. But first, we we return now to the story of my recent visit.
Hey, I'm Sam.
Hey, Sam.
With a group of competitive gunfighters.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. You have these other names out here. We've got names like Venom and Widowmaker and Gravedigger. You know, these are all angry names. And then you got Apple Pie, you know.
Apple Pie is one of those aliases Deborah and Matthew were telling me about. After we spoke in their kitchen, they invited me to a practice shoot in a dusty field at Rio Salado Sportsman's Club in Mesa at the foot of Usury Mountain. They'd set up a shooting line and targets, and club members took turns firing off practice rounds.
Line's ready.
Okay, here come your commands. Shooters on the line. Shooters, set. Somebody hit the pole. No time across the board.
It was dusk, and the air was filled with purple clouds and gun smoke. Between rounds, Apple Pie told me how he got his alias.
That was a military name. When I signed up, I was young little 17-year-old. When I reported in, he says, you look like you should be at home selling mom's apple pie.
When I asked Apple Pie what he likes about Fast Draw, his voice started to quiver.
We're all represented.
Yep.
And you might be shooting against a Purple Heart or an 8-year-old. You never know. That's what we call the luck of the draw. It's a bond, you know. We've got a lot of camaraderie out here.
As I was talking to Apple Pie, Deborah came over and stood quietly next to me. There was a twinkle in her eye. When Apple Pie excused himself to load his revolver, Deborah asked if I wanted to try shooting a few rounds.
Are you going to try it?
Yeah, well, why not? Sure.
All of a sudden, I found myself being fitted with a holster. A guy who introduced himself as Mule Train handed me a revolver and showed me how to pull it out, cock the hammer, and pull the trigger. Someone handed me a safety release form. As I leaned down to fill it out, it occurred to me that, until that moment, I'd never even held a gun, let alone fired one.
You have an alias, want to make one up, or you can just use your regular name and put it over there.
I could make up an alias?
Yeah, sure. Sure can.
I'm frozen. I don't know what to choose.
Yosemite Sam.
Sold.
Put Yosemite Sam or whatever you're doing there.
I stepped up to the line and squinted at the metal target with the red light in the center. I tried to remember all the steps I'd just practiced. Mule Train could see my wheels turning. He leaned over my shoulder and whispered in my ear, "Don't aim." The light turned red and I heard a popping sound.
There you go. Nice.
Nice. Okay. I hit it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I didn't remember drawing or firing, but when I looked over at the target, there was a tiny wax dot near the middle. I turned to Matthew.
I get it.
I told you, it's like cocaine, dude. It's like you just got to do it again.
And I did. In fact, I shot a few more rounds that night. Before I knew it, a couple hours had gone by.
Yep.
And as I walked out to the parking lot, it happened. For the first time in months, ever since I packed up my life and moved to Arizona, 2,700 miles from my fiance and my life back east, I felt this unmistakable sense of peace.
I just walked out here into the parking lot. It's dead quiet except for the pop of the guns. There's saguaros everywhere. Sunset is purple. I'm surrounded by these magnificent peaks. And earlier today, I was so stressed out. I was thinking about the wedding. I was thinking about my friendship with I was thinking about money. And all I was thinking about for the last 2 hours was just dropping into this. And when I was shooting, when I did it the best, it was just look at the target, don't think. And I feel so much more at ease now than I did when I got here. And I haven't felt that way in a long time.
A few months later, when I got to the state shoot at Pioneer Living History Museum, I wanted to tell Matthew how good I felt that day after practice. But I was nervous. The things I'm going through felt so insignificant compared to what he and Deborah are dealing with every day. After my first conversation with Matthew that morning, when he told me he wasn't interested in any consolation prizes, I lost track of him and Deborah. So I wandered around for a while, watching gunfighters take the line. One group was playfully squabbling about a defective target. The judges were concerned that it was registering hits even when shooters missed the mark. "It's just sensitive," one of the shooters yelled. The judge shouted back.
"Ain't no sensitivity in fast draw."
A few yards away, a solitary shooter was leaning against a fence with a harmonica, playing Lowrider. When I finally bumped into Matthew again, I took a deep breath and told him I'd been reflecting on the whole don't aim thing. I told him how comforting it had been to spend a few hours as Yosemite Sam instead of regular Sam. And I told him how silly I felt, comparing those feelings to the power of fast draw in his life. When I finished, Matthew just grinned.
This is very different. It's very personal, you know, because this is you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He took out his phone and showed me a playlist he listens to when he's getting ready to shoot. One of the songs he added recently is called Jesus Saves by Cooper Allen. It's a song about embracing your imperfections. Early in the song, Cooper Allen sings, "I ain't a Sunday morning choir, I'm a dirty boots in the back pew backslider. I ain't easy to love, more washed in the whiskey than washed in the blood."
He's just like, yeah, that's me. I'm that, you know, dirty boots center sitting in the back row. More washed in the whiskey than I am the blood. It's because this is a work in progress, and I'm just not completely there yet. I don't know anybody who's completely there yet, but I want to be.
Ain't no sensitivity in fast draw? I respectfully disagree. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Right.
Here in the West, ongoing drought and a drier future are forcing us all to think about how we use water differently. Last summer, my co-host Lauren Gilger went up to northern Arizona to meet one farmer who's living it. Michael Katutwa Johnson is a Hopi farmer and U of A faculty member. His fields are about an hour and a half north of Flagstaff. He uses an ancient technique to grow corn and squash and beans with no irrigation.
When Michael Katutwa Johnson walks through his fields in the high desert of northern Arizona, he can hear the corn talk to him.
Early in the morning or in the evening, it's just that you can hear them talking because they just it's a cool sound.
It's Hopi corn, an ancient variety that Johnson's family has been growing on this land on the Hopi Reservation for nearly 100 years.
So when you're out here hoeing weeds, you're out here talking to them, and you're also, touching them, and you get very intimate with this corn. You know, you can hear the leaves rustling, and they're just waking up. You know, kind of neat.
The corn is not just a crop to Johnson; it's a family member of sorts, a being for sure, and part of a long tradition his grandfather taught him, and he carries on today.
I'm growing a few things. I'm growing about four different varieties of Hopi corn and some beans and also some gourds and squash up here.
But looking around this windy, high desert field, you won't see the kind of farmland you might expect. For one, there's not a tree in sight for miles. The dirt is dry and dusty. You can see Flagstaff's San Francisco peaks in the distance. But there, like a kind of mirage in the desert, are bright green stalks popping out of the ground.
It's kind of unique out here. It's kind of like a semi-desert out here. We don't get any irrigation. This corn that we're looking at is an early corn that I put in April, the end of April, and so it hasn't had water in over 60 days, but you can tell by the vibrancy and the greenness of it how well it's doing.
That's right. He grows these crops without any irrigation. It's called dry Hopi farming. It's an ancient practice that uses only the water that falls from the sky to grow crops every year. That's about 6 to 10 inches of annual rainfall in this region. Without irrigation, Johnson uses a variety of techniques perfected over millennia to grow his crops, from planting clumps of seeds 6 feet apart from one another to planting seeds 18 inches deep to seep whatever moisture lives in the earth.
We had an abundance of snowfall this year, and that's what really makes our crops thrive, and that's why we don't have to irrigate. Our next big thing will be the monsoon rains to fill out the kernel cobs and also to fill out the bean pods, which will happen usually at the last week of July. That's when it hits us out here. But everything by then should be pretty well grown, starting to tassel and everything like that, and we should have a pretty good harvest this year.
Johnson isn't just a farmer, although he has taken on the stewardship of his family's land and doesn't plan on letting it go anytime soon. Today, people also call him Dr. Michael Kotutwa Johnson. He's an assistant specialist in indigenous resiliency at the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona, and a sought-after resource on his culture's farming practices worldwide.
I myself call myself about a 253rd generation farmer here. You know, I like to kind of joke around about that because, you know, I have colleagues in Iowa and Nebraska who are farmers too, and they can only get about 2-3 generations back. So it's kind of fun.
It was summer on his farm when I visited him there, months before any crops would be ready for harvest. But it was clear walking through the rows with him and talking about the practice, it's not really about how much is harvested. That much he feels is out of his hands. It's about tradition and culture and history.
We're an agricultural society. You know, I would feel like we're kind of like America's original farmers. You know, we've been doing this from the get-go. We don't usually use mechanical machinery, but we've developed over the time a one-row cultivator, a straight-blade cultivator to tangle the weeds, and we also have a one-row deep planter because our planting depths range from anywhere to 6.5 feet deep, and so we've adapted planters to do that too.
So when we say dry Hopi farming, like you're talking about not using irrigation at all, and you do a lot of things to make sure the plants still grow, right? Like you mentioned these corns and the spacing and how they're, you know, much further apart than a cornfield I would see in the valley, right? Those are like packed together. So this is knowledge that sounds like it's been passed down for a long time, but there are a lot of different techniques, it sounds like.
Yeah, there are a lot of techniques. You know, for example, if you can look around out here, you'll see clumps of plants. You'll have about 8 or 9 stalks in one clump per one hole. And that's basically to help them protect each other from the heat of the sun, and also allows them to self-pollinate pretty easily because they are next to each other, so they basically pollinate each other. And so spacing is not really much of a problem out here. And it is, you know, the soils that we use, and the monsoon rains brings in all new soils. The pH level is on this. Anybody who knows anything about agriculture, pH is a very important concept. It's about 8.3, 8.8 still after 60 years of just continuous corn. There's no sense to rotate crops out here because we get that new flux of soils pretty much every year, and so that's the main thing. And the other thing too is that when we take our ears of corn, we just knock down the plant, leave the plant on the ground, and then what happens a falling winter is they act like snow catchers. As the snow blows across the field, it catches up in those areas, and then we plant in between the rows the following year, the leftover rows, and so that's where your nutrient values are, and that's where your moisture's at, and so you get used to it, and you don't really question it. Only when I went to school, you know, at Cornell University when I got my undergrad way back in 99, did I have to question myself because they wanted to know how I was doing these things, and they're amazed, and they're probably still amazed, and so that's where I'm at right now.
Let's walk around a little. So you are these corn as well? These are smaller.
These are smaller corn. I plant out here every couple of weeks. I put in a different variety of corn every couple of weeks, or the same variety, just because I want to make sure that I get something like that. The moisture level changes over time, so you put your early corn in first, see how that does, and then every couple of weeks you plant another variety out here. I was told to do that because we're trying to optimize what the soil moisture is going to give us and see which one does the best. But this year we've had a problem with cutworms, so sometimes we have to replant. So, you know, it's one of those things out here. You know, we don't have any pesticides, herbicides, any of that stuff that we use. It's all manual labor, very labor intensive, but the human well-being produced from that is important because you get healthy, you get strong, you know, and plus the food you produce is about 10 times higher nutrient value than the stuff you buy in the store.
10 times higher. So this is, you've talked about the rainfall, the pH level in the soil. Now you're talking about the 10 times nutrient value. It sounds like incredibly scientific.
It is scientific because people wanted me to make it that way. I think that's the problem with that. You know, a lot of people can't understand that what we do is based upon 3,000 years of knowledge, 3,000 years of replication. you know, and we need to move beyond just looking at the practices and the processes. We need to look at the values of why we do this and what and why we're farmers. I think that's most important.
That's really interesting. So you're saying, like, as you studied this in academia, essentially, you kind of discovered the science behind what you sort of innately knew to be true just from learning it for your entire life?
Yeah, it's kind of funny like that. I always like to say, like, you know, our system proves the science. You know? It doesn't go the other way around, you know, and because we have a lot more crop science integrated through our traditional means than what Western science does today. I mean, our system goes back 3,000 years old. Western commodity crops only go back about maybe 150 years when they started industrializing it. And so, yeah. You know, our knowledge base is way, way beyond anything that Western science is as far as crop management can imagine.
I wonder also, because I know that you also study this in a, like, almost a spiritual capacity, right? Like you and in the Hopi culture look at the seeds as sacred, as family.
Yeah, we do. And I think, you know, that's one of the important things that people have to understand, that these things are life. You know, life produces life. So every time we get a cob and every time we hold that little cob up into the air, we can see just new generations coming to come out. And so we take care of them just like we take care of ourselves. And that's very important, because here in the United States, you know, indigenous people don't really have the right to their own seeds or the intellectual property because of the Plant Variety Protection Act. And so I'm trying to make changes on that. One of the biggest things that I'm trying to do is trying to make sure that seeds, indigenous seeds, are also looked at as cultural patrimony under the Native American Grave Repatriation Act, and they should be, because that should give us the intellectual properties we need to basically protect these seeds and also repatriate them from museums to put them back into the communities and raise them out again.
Are they in museums? Is that a thing you can go and view, like at a Smithsonian?
Yes, they are. A lot of museums have our seeds from their archaeological digs. You know, whether or not they're viable or not, that remains determined. But we sure would like to have some of those back. They're like our boarding school. They're like the boarding school children. They've been taken away from us, and we want to have them back home again.
So bring this home for me a little bit. Like, when you talk about seeds as family, as intellectual property, how does this feel to you personally? Like, you come out here and sing to the seeds? Like, there are ceremonies involved.
Yes, there's a lot of ceremonies involved. You know, these things have life. And I think, you know, they, in my mind, they're persons. And so a lot of the work that I'm trying to do is that they're very, very sacred to us. They've adapted to our environment. They've changed with us as we've changed as people. And so they're taken care of as such. And so I wish people can understand that these things are real life to us. And they're very, very important that we get these back to the native communities where they came from.
It's an incredibly different way of looking at the earth, right? And at life in general.
Yes, it is. It's kind of like a really big reciprocal relationship, a back and forth sharing relationship, I think, that, you know, we're trying to do. You know, like, when we look at regenerative agriculture, they're still stuck in the processes and the techniques of that. You know, they should really be looking at what makes this 80% of biodiversity that's managed by on 25% of the land, only by 5% of the population, what are indigenous. What are indigenous people are doing right, and what is allowing them to do that right? And to me, it's their underlying cultural belief system, their value system. You know, here in America, we do have a value system, but it's far from where it should be in order to take care of each other as families and as people.
We'll be back with more of that conversation with Michael Kotutwa Johnson about dry Hopi farming after the break. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Let's return to our conversation with Hopi farmer and U of A faculty Michael Kotutwa Johnson at his farm in northern Arizona. Johnson uses dry Hopi farming, an ancient practice he learned from his grandfather, and he's been making an academic effort to repatriate native seeds to indigenous people.
Is this the same field that you've worked with your grandfather and your dad when you were a kid?
Yeah, it is. You know, it hasn't changed much. Even the fence posts are still here. They're cedar fence posts. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time out here as a kid, especially hoeing weeds, you know, and I didn't like to come out here because, you know, we only had, you know, one channel out here from Flagstaff. And I spent a lot of time just hoeing weeds out here, planting, and just running around as a kid.
So what are your memories of that? Like, obviously hard work, it sounds like, and kids always don't love hard work, clearly. But did you enjoy it in a way? Like, do you have fond memories of it?
Yeah, I do. You know, it was a time of my life, you know, where, you know, when you're a kid, a lot of things are fun, but it was a time of my life that, you know, as I reflect back onto it, very important as far as, you know, where I'm at today. You know, I have a bigger brother and a little sister, and they don't come out here much at all. And so it kind of integrated to me, and it brought me back home. And so this is my real home out here, and I really, really enjoy it.
So you went to Cornell, and you obviously continued academic work after that. You're a professor now. It sounds like it's really combined with your academic and your professional purpose as well.
Yeah, you know, I work for the University of Arizona. My home department is the School of Natural Resources and the Environment, but a lot of that work is extension. And so a lot of my work is going out and outreaching to tribal communities and other communities who may need my help. But a lot of what I'm really trying to do, especially with the Indigenous Resiliency Center that I'm a part of at the University of Arizona, is bring recognition first to the contributions we've made as Indigenous people, because we can't really talk about equity until we're recognized. See, we're still in too many ways stuck on in black and white on museum walls. But here I am out in my field doing the same thing my ancestors have been doing for over 3,000 years, but I'm just not wearing a loincloth. I'm wearing a nice shirt and some pants.
There are certain ways the times have changed.
Yeah, there are certain ways the times have changed, and clothing's one of them. But, you know, really not much has changed as far as our system. You know, I've got photographs that go back 100 years, and you can see, comparing what I'm doing now and what I'm doing now, that the management system has not changed that much at all, if any. And so we're still doing the way we're doing it because it works.
Is there a reason these four posts are out here in the middle of the field?
Yeah, I'm going to build what they call a kisi. That's going to be a place that I'm going to sleep sometimes in the afternoon. So I'm going to put a roof on it and shade in there and sleep out there. Because a long time ago, before we, you know, we had all these homes out here, the men would spend a majority of their day out in the fields, and then they would tend to their fields, and then they would go home in the evening time. But they would basically also sleep out here too, because if you leave your field for too long, then things happen, bad things happen, like a deer would come in, or you won't be able to see a cutworm or stuff like that. But you got to be out here, because these plants, like I said, are living human beings, so they don't like to be left by themselves too, especially when they're children like this. They're just real small, and they're just now coming of age.
So I know you do a lot of, you said outreach, and you mentioned when I got here a couple of the groups that have just been here, right? Like little kids, college students who come out and study this, Indigenous people who maybe aren't as connected to this. How do you feel about the sort of teaching aspect of this farm and like showing people what it is that you do and the importance of it?
Well, you know, I think the first thing that I'm trying to do is teach my own, you know, my own community members, the youth out here. That's the most important thing I do first. You have to take care of your community first before you take care of others. But for the most part, I really like to have people come visit me out here. This is a unique place to be. It's away from the villages, and so you're not intruding on anything that's going on up there. And it is a good place to not only do, you know, I wouldn't say research, but just come out here and see what's going on. This is a different way of doing agriculture, totally.
So I want to ask you lastly, as we walk through here, oh, that one didn't make it, huh?
That one didn't make it. I don't know. It's probably gone. Cut one. There it looks like it.
Can you tell?
No. Yeah, he would be here if I. He would be here, so he must have died or did it. But
the cutworm would be here if it was that.
Yeah, it's there, but.
So I wonder if you're going about this like without irrigation. Are there years it just doesn't happen? Like, is climate change affecting this ancient practice?
Yeah, it has. You know, I've been watching this field for a number of years. Over the last 10 years, sometimes we have a crop, sometimes we don't. It does affect it because of the winter moisture that comes in here, and also the monsoon rains. And so I just feel like, you know, that has affected us. But, you know, as Hopi people, we've adapted many times. You know, over the last 3,000 years, we've had 200 years droughts. We've adapted. Sometimes we had to move, but then we came back. It's just us, you know, going through another cycle again. This year is a good year, and so we just take advantage of a good year. Also, you know, we're smart enough to plant enough to last us in a good year like this, to try to last just 3 to 5 years seed-wise. That's something that we were told to do and things like that. And so you can see all the vegetation out here, how green everything is pretty much, and how much soil moisture is in the ground, because we're able to look at some of this vegetation will tell us how deep we need to plant, how far we need to plant, just by what we see in the springtime. Sometimes I like to do a check. This year, for example, when I was putting in one of my posts out here for my fence, you know, I was digging down 3 feet and moisture was still there. So these corn will do fine. They'll just keep growing.
So where does the sort of effort stand right now in terms of recognition, like you talked about, and the effort you've been undergoing for some time to try to get recognition, patrimonial recognition for these seeds?
Well, the recognition's coming along real good. I'm working on something very special here. I'm meeting with the park superintendent at Mesa Verde National Park, and we're talking, opening discussions, or have been having discussions about doing an indigenous crop up there based on Pueblo agriculture, because that was the home of the 23 Pueblos that are in New Mexico, Texas, and Arizona now. And so for the National Park Service to open up their doors and open up what used to be our land, you know, to get us to plant up there again, to bring back some of these varieties home where they once were, I think is a tremendous opportunity to bring that recognition. Because not only will we talk about this history and the historical part, we'll also talk about the indigenous ingenuity, how we raise these things like you're looking at here right now, how we're able to raise these things with no irrigation, probably about 90 days, 120 days of no irrigation.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Michael, for having me out. I appreciate it.
You're welcome very much. I appreciate it. You come back again.
You can see photos of Johnson's fields and his harvest on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. The Biden administration this fall issued new rules aimed at achieving parity between mental and physical health. Among other provisions, the rules prohibit health plans from using more restrictive prior authorizations for mental health than physical health, and require plans to analyze their provider networks to make sure patients can access mental health care. Congress has passed measures aimed at mental health parity in the past, and while there has been progress in this area, there is also more to do. Marisa Domino is a health economist in ASU's College of Health Solutions and executive director of the Center for Health Information and Research. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about this, and they started with what she makes of the new rules the Biden administration has put out related to this.
They're a move in the right direction. I think they're not going to solve the problem in terms of eliminating disparities between mental health and medical surgical benefits. But I think that this is a really complicated area. And I think, you know, we've seen progression over the last 20 to 30 years, and this is still a move in the right direction.
Why is it so complicated? Like, why is it so hard for health insurance to cover mental and behavioral health the same way it covers physical health?
In part because coverage is a really complicated thing. So when we think of insurance coverage, we might think of what our co-payments are, how much do we have to spend every time we go to the doctor, you know, and those are set by the insurance company. But there's also other things called non-quantity treatment limits. So behind the scenes, the insurers can have other tools that they can use to control the kinds of services and the quantity of services we use. So one example is something called prior authorization for certain kinds of benefits, services used. You actually, you know, just can't go to the pharmacy and fill a prescription. There might be a process where your provider has to get permission specifically for certain kinds of treatments from the health insurer before, you know, you can actually obtain the treatment or service. And those are more commonly used in behavioral health care than they are on the medical surgical side. So even though we might say, you know, the co-payments are the same, what the patient has to pay out of pocket are the same, there might be efforts behind the scenes that control or restrict the supply of those services that are available to patients.
Is there something that the government could be doing to try to increase parity? Like, is this even something the government can facilitate?
There are greater efforts that can be made. So, you know, one of my mentors, Richard Frank, who works at the Brookings Institute, recently published a letter to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services director, indicating that, you know, there may be other ways, like examining outcomes, examining the percent of patients that use behavioral health services and comparing that to the percent who use primary care. We wouldn't expect those to be equal, but there may be sort of a predictable fraction of people who need behavioral health services, and keeping an eye on that, comparing that across health insurance plans, across populations, may be a way to at least better get at who's got access to services versus who's being restricted by either quantitative or non-quantitative treatment limits.
Is any of this related to the fact that in many ways, behavioral or mental health, when people are having having issues with them, like, it's not as obvious as like a broken arm or, you know, you're having a heart attack or something like that. Is there still that element at play here?
Unfortunately, yes. I think that's very much the case. I think we don't have a litmus test for a mental illness. We rely on people to tell us about the symptoms that they're experiencing and the burden of illness that they're feeling from this constellation of symptoms. And unlike, you know, diabetes, where we have a very specific test that indicates whether somebody has diabetes or doesn't, or as you indicate, an X-ray for a broken bone or not, we really just don't have that level of diagnostics in mental health. And I think there's still, you know, a fair amount of stigma against mental illnesses and substance use disorders.
What are the conversations like in your world right now about what the new administration might do in this area come January?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, there's concerns about restrictions in benefits. I think that there's been a lot of progress made with the idea that a lot of health can be improved, not just through health services, but through improvements in what are often called health-related social factors or social determinants of health, things like food insecurity, housing instability. Those are areas that we've seen a lot of progress with health plans, especially Medicaid programs, being able to fund really innovative programs in that area that have spillover effects on health. And I think that there's a concern that some of those initiatives, you know, might be pulled in the current administration. So I think that's one area of concern, and just generosity of benefits. I think, you know, there's a strong emphasis on private sector care, you know, possibly to the detriment of public approaches to providing healthcare, which I think are just so instrumental, especially in behavioral health, since there are these complex mechanisms where, you know, the price structure may not work as well as it does for, you know, the consumption of apples or something like that. That's fairly straightforward through the private sector.
Hmm. Do you think this is the kind of thing that individual states could take up? Like, if the federal government isn't doing enough in the minds of some folks, is this something that like Arizona officials could try to put into place here, or is there just not enough scale for that?
No, absolutely. I think that states do a lot in this space individually. So one of the really great things about the Medicaid program is they're a state-federal partnership. Mm-hmm. And so the federal government creates a set of ground rules that all states must follow, but states have a lot of opportunity for innovation. And so I think states could absolutely require new outcomes being monitored when care is being contracted out to private health plans or even public health plans so that, you know, they can ensure that there's access. I think, you know, we often talk about the provider network, the providers who accept the particular kind of insurance, and there's already a lot being done in that space that's required by states. Some states to, you know, require health plans to make sure that they have enough providers available to serve the expected needs of the populations that they're insuring.
Is there movement in this area in Arizona?
Oh, absolutely. I think Arizona's Medicaid program Access has just been a real innovator in the behavioral health space. They've come up with new criteria, new ways to integrate mental health and primary care together so that people are receiving seamless care, whether they have medical surgical needs or behavioral health needs. They've set new standards, you know, to watch to make sure that access really is happening on a meaningful basis. So I think Arizona's been a real exemplar in this space.
All right. That is Marisa Domino, a health economist and executive director of the Center for Health Information and Research at ASU's College of Health Solutions. Marisa, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed talking with you, Mark. Thank you.
This past week, students at Alhambra High School have shared stories of gratitude for a mom who leaves tacos on the nightstand, a great-grandma with important life lessons, and a sister who sets the pace at the gym. Now, 11th grader Brittany Perez Sanchez will explain what she's grateful for.
My church is the place I feel the most safe. I go to Ministerio Casa del Rey. I have gone to that church for over 7 years now. I was Catholic and converted to Christianity. I am grateful because they taught me how to love myself and stay close to God. I am thankful for the many memories we made and experiences we shared. They show me how to make friends and how to forgive someone. They show me how to become a better person and how to live a happier life. My church taught me how to get along with people. I cherish many memories of my church, and I'm friends with the youth of my church. Most of my time and peace is at church. They help me through my anxiety attacks, downfalls, and problems in my life, whether they were my love life, school, home, or myself. This reminds me of a time of a couple weeks ago when I was at a church event, and I got emotional and had an anxiety attack. The eldest daughter of the pastor's children helped me out and prayed for me in those moments of weaknesses. I remember that the eldest daughter of her pastor, Emily, said to me, "Entrega tus problemas y andes a Dios y Él te ayudará mientras oramos por ti y Él quita que estás problemas y entres que tengas y Él te sanará." Give your problems and anxiety to God, and He will help you as we pray for you. And He will take away those problems and stress that have, and He will heal you. When Emily told me this, I was happy. I had someone there to help me out with my problems. Church isn't always serious, but it's a place where we can also have fun. During October of this year, my church and my family went to a pumpkin patch. It was a fun experience. We went and talked about the pumpkin patch. We ate food. We went to corn mazes. I got lost with my cousins and their parents. We were stuck for 2 hours in the maze, and we were tired and thirsty. I remember my younger cousin said, "We aren't getting out of this place. I faint now." She was being dramatic at the moment, and I was like, "Really, girls, stop being way too dramatic." Around 10 minutes later, we got out, and she ran to get water. Soon she fell asleep on the hay that was everywhere, and her older brother had to take her home. The rest of her church was able to get out of the maze, and we all went to go eat at In-N-Out. Every Wednesdays and Sundays we have church. We all pray for each other, as small children are learning from their parents, and soon we'll be the next generation of our church.
That was high school student Brittany Perez Sanchez. You can hear all of the essays in this Soapbox series at kjzz.org. And finally, on a personal note, I have been thinking a lot recently about my first adult Thanksgiving. It was 2004. I was just out of college. And on Thanksgiving morning, I finished an overnight shift at the Millennium Hilton in Lower Manhattan, where I was working as a bellman, and I took the subway up to Lincoln Center. I met up at a diner with my friend Marshall, who was just getting off the overnight at the Sheraton. Marshall and I grew up together in Virginia. And as we slumped into our booth and ordered black coffee, I immediately started complaining about how much I wished we were at home with our families. I was pining for my mom's chopped liver. She always makes it with my grandmother's hand crank food processor. Marshall admitted he had spent the whole night dreaming of his dad's oysters and the way he always curses when he breaks them open. But we couldn't be there because we both had to work the overnight shift to pay the bills while we tried to make our dreams come true. Marshall was interning as a video producer at the Wall Street Journal, and I was volunteering as a producer at WNYC. And as we ordered refill after refill of our coffees, I just couldn't stop bemoaning how unfair it was that we had to celebrate Thanksgiving this way. In her essay, Brittany mentioned giving your problems and anxieties to God. And while I am not personally religious, I have always felt like I could bring my problems and anxieties to Marshall. And I will never forget what he told me that morning. "Sam," he said, "we chose this. This is what it costs to get to where we want to go." These days, Marshall is a senior producer at a major news network. And as I have sat here this week talking on the radio, which seemed like such a distant fantasy back then, I have been reflecting on his wise words and how grateful I am for that diner Thanksgiving. Wherever you are celebrating this week, I hope you've got good people to talk to. And I thank you for listening to us here at the show. For Mark Brody, Lauren Gilger, and our whole team, I'm Yosemite Sam Dingman. Have a wonderful holiday.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today. Thank you.